ruler. Second, and more important, all of Umbridge's torment tactics reveal her inner lust for power. Take, for instance, Harry's detentions with Umbridge in Order of the Phoenix. She instructs him, "I want you to write. I must not tell lies, as long as it takes for the message to sink in." This sink in, as we all know, is quite literal, and her cruelty seems only to increase relative to the amount of power she is given. As the year progresses, and she attains a more prominent role of authority at Hogwarts by the Ministry, her decrees multiply, as do her detentions. We might even speculate that her incremental increases in authority merely fuel her lust for more power. One thing is certain, though. Plato would have expelled her from his academy. Whereas Umbridge never rose to the position of Minister of Magic, the almost equally dangerous and inept Cornelius Fudge did. Part of what made him such a poor minister was his perpetual fear of losing power. This concern fostered dictatorial tendencies that manifested in a control of the press. The Dark Lord's return to power was partly due to Fudge's failings as a leader. For example, when Harry announced that Voldemort had in fact returned, Fudge resorted to trashing Harry in the press in order to maintain his own public image, an image that only got worse once the truth came out. Umbridge's position as the Hogwarts High Inquisitor is another example of Fudge's attempts to maintain power in unjust ways. Recall how at the beginning of Order of the Phoenix, Harry is brought to court for producing a Patronus to protect himself and his cousin Dudley from Dementors. The Dementors were not supposed to be away from Azkaban. To cover up the Ministry's mistake, Fudge brings Harry to trial and does all that he can to tilt the scales against him. He moves the time of the hearing, for instance, in an attempt to make Harry late and to prevent Dumbledore from attending. All of this goes to show that Fudge's virtues as a ruler are at best dubious. He craves power, but his insecurity leads him to use that power for his own advantage, rather than for the public good. He stumbles over himself in his attempts to maintain power, which prevents him in the end from keeping it. So, like Umbridge, Fudge lacks the key features Plato described as necessary for successful ruling, particularly courage, wisdom, and self-control. Voldemort and Dumbledore, 2. Tempted by Power. Self-confidence and decisiveness are certainly not qualities lacking in Lord Voldemort. Even during his humble beginnings in the orphanage, Tom Riddle was drawn to power. He was already using magic against other people to frighten, to punish, to control. The strangled rabbit and the young boy and girl he lured into a cave were most suggestive. "I can make them hurt if I want to." Contrary to the great Enlightenment philosopher Immanuel Kant's dictum, never to use another person merely as a means to an end, Riddle used others as a means to feed his desires and ambitions. The fledgling Death Eaters, a group of dedicated friends, were not friends at all, only followers. Riddle undoubtedly felt no affection for any of them, Dumbledore tells Harry. Riddle's great intelligence and social cunning were a deadly pair. A great suck-up, as well as a skilled wizard, he was a star at Hogwarts, not only with his cronies, but with the faculty as well. This attitude reveals Riddle's unwavering egocentrism, a trait that gets more pronounced as he becomes Lord Voldemort. Two clear examples of this excessive self-love also reveal Voldemort's intense craving for power and his paradoxical ability to harm himself in securing it. The murder of Lily Potter and the creation of the Horcruxes. Despite his key followers' wishes, Voldemort kills Lily, Severus Snape's great love. Perhaps Voldemort feels that Snape will not leave his side, regardless of what he does. Perhaps he does not care. Voldemort's quest is his own, and others are valued by him only as tools to serve his own desires. His lust for immortality, even at the cost of splintering his own soul, is the ultimate proof of his evil and his propensity for tyranny. Finally, we cannot neglect Voldemort's schemes to gain power at the Ministry. Although he realizes that his reputation prohibits his direct seizure of power as Minister of Magic, he lusts after the office's powers and plants others there as instruments of his desires. With his ruthless egotism, keen intelligence, and tyrannical tendencies, Voldemort fits perfectly into Plato's category of least trustworthy rulers. Perhaps a character better fit to rule is Albus Dumbledore. He was offered the post of Minister of Magic not once, but several times, and he is, after all, the most philosophical character in the Harry Potter series, making him the obvious choice as philosopher-ruler. Nearly every tale concludes with a lesson from the wise sage, brilliantly tying together the previous year's events with all of their manifold meanings. In Half-Blood Prince, while engrossed in the pensieve, Dumbledore delves into questions regarding human nature and the moral psychology of evil, giving Harry and us important clues as to what a ruler ought to be like. Dumbledore even exhibits all of the key traits a philosopher-ruler must have. He is courageous, just, and wise, and has self-mastery. Or does he? In Deathly Hallows, we learn that Dumbledore was tempted by power in his youth, along with his friend and soon-to-be dark wizard, Gellert Grindelwald. He admits of this period that,
"I had learned that I was not to be trusted with power, that power was my weakness and my temptation."
Many years later, after having realized his dangerous will to power, he is tempted again by Marvolo Gaunt's ring, the ring that ultimately shortens his life. What makes Dumbledore venerable, even with these flaws, is his self-knowledge. Plato's teacher, Socrates, instructed his students to know themselves. Dumbledore had enough self-knowledge to know that he could not be trusted with power. This simple realization makes the crucial difference. It prevents him from accepting the offer to be Minister of Magic, which would confer the power he so desires. And so, although unfit to rule, as it turns out, Dumbledore never reaches the dark lows of Grindelwald or Voldemort, although he potentially could have. Dumbledore promotes justice in the wizard community simply by knowing himself, resisting the power he craves, and passing his lessons on to his students. Had Dumbledore succumbed to his own temptations, Voldemort might have had a competitor as the most sinister character of Harry Potter. Dumbledore's Socratic self-knowledge and Platonic teachings reveal the qualities that virtuous Potter characters embody. They have self-knowledge and are guided by justice, courage, and wisdom. Perhaps the best exemplar of these traits is Harry himself. Harry's Cloak, the Ring of Gyges, and the Temptations of Power. As it turns out, Harry can be trusted with power. How can we be sure? Recall Plato's Ring of Gyges. It measures our probity, or incorruptibility, by asking what we would do if we were invisible. Rowling resurrects Plato's character Amita with Harry's invisibility cloak. Throughout the series, Harry has countless opportunities to abuse his unique power. He never once, aside from breaking some minor rules, such as staying out late, used it to his own advantage at the expense of others. Unlike Gyges, Harry certainly did not kill and seize political control. He instead sought to use his power for the greater good, the real greater good, that is. In the face of an opportunity for advancement, Scrimgeour's offer of Harry's dream job, Harry seeks not his own interests, but those of the entire wizarding community. As Harry learns of Horcruxes, the most dangerous idea in all of dark magic, he is not tempted to seek eternal life through murder, as was Voldemort. Rather, Harry relentlessly searches to destroy the Horcruxes, employing his cloak for the purpose. As early as Sorcerer's Stone, Harry displays this admirable quality. As he faces Voldemort for the first time, at age 11, Harry looks into the Mirror of Erised and finds the Sorcerer's Stone in his pocket. Dumbledore's enchantment, allowing the stone to be found only by someone who had no intention of using it, reveals Harry's lack of selfish desire. Harry's indifference to the lure of power, it turns out, is the very quality that both Plato and Dumbledore celebrate as conducive to wise and just statecraft. Harry certainly possesses the other necessary virtues to rule, such as courage, justice, and self-restraint, but so do many others. Therefore, it really is this piece of Platonic wisdom, revived and put at the fore of Rowling's world, that ought to guide our search for those fit to rule. Although Harry is ordinary and easy for readers to relate to, there really is something magical about his immunity to the lust for power. Part 4. The Room of Requirement, A Potter Potpourri. Chapter 10. Is Dumbledore gay? Who's to say? Tamma Szabo Gendler. On October 19th, 2007, before a packed audience at Carnegie Hall in New York City, J.K. Rowling made a remarkable announcement. In response to a question about whether Albus Dumbledore had ever been in love, Rowling announced that she had always thought of Dumbledore as gay. Reaction was immediate and emphatic. Within 2 days, close to 3,000 comments had been posted at the Leaky Cauldron message board, with another 2,500 at MuggleNet. There were articles in Time and Newsweek, reports on CNN and NBC, and even an op-ed piece in the New York Times. Responses fell into three categories. Some readers were delighted by the news, as one Leaky Cauldron poster wrote, "You go, Joe. Finally a strong, wise, non-stereotypical portrayal of a gay man." A second group was dismayed. "I'm extremely disappointed at Joe for her comments on Dumbledore. It was not necessary for her to promote such a perverse lifestyle in connection to a series of books that millions of children will take interest in now and in the future," wrote another. But the most interesting type of response was the third. These readers responded to the declaration by challenging Rowling's authorial authority. "Unless she decides to write Book 8, Ms. Rowling has missed her chance to impart any new information about any of the Harry Potter characters. If the series is truly at an end, then the author no longer possesses the authority to create new thoughts, feelings, and realities for those characters," wrote one reader. "To insist on ownership, as she has done, and the right to define or redefine those characters as she sees fit after the fact, is to insist on an absolute control over the literary experience of her readers she cannot possibly have," wrote another. On its surface, this third response is perplexing. After all, at the Carnegie Hall interview, Rowling revealed all sorts of things that are not explicitly part of the Harry Potter stories. She told the audience about things that happened after the Potter books end, about things that happened before the books begin, and about things that happened during the books. But no one wrote in to comment that Neville Longbottom didn't go on to marry Hannah Abbott, or that Remus Lupin, prior to Dumbledore taking him in, didn't lead a really impoverished life because no one wanted to employ a werewolf, or that Petunia Dursley didn't almost wish Harry luck when she said goodbye to him at the beginning of Deathly Hallows, all of which were things that Rowling revealed only in the course of the interview. What we face here is a version of what philosophers call the problem of truth in fiction. Are there facts about what is true in the world of a story? And if so, what determines those facts? Is it simply a matter of the statements that are canonically expressed by the story's author? What role is played by the story's readers or hearers, or by what the author was thinking? What about conventions governing the genre to which the story belongs? And so on. Truth in fiction. Because we're trying to determine whether a particular statement is true in a work of fiction, one obvious strategy would be to think about the problem in analogy with non-fiction. So let's ask, how does a historian or a biographer go about determining whether a particular statement is true? Well, she looks at the way the actual world happens to be, using things such as archival documents and historical records and archaeological evidence. On this basis, she might determine that the statement, "George Washington was President of the United States," is true. It's true because, in the actual world, George Washington was President of the United States. How would this go in the fictional case? Can we learn that George Weasley was a Gryffindor beater is true, of the world of Harry Potter, by learning that, in the world of Harry Potter, George was a Gryffindor beater? In the case of George Washington, we looked at the actual world. So, in the case of George Weasley, we simply have to look at the Harry Potter world. The problem is, we don't really know which world that is. After all, presumably there is some other imaginary world. Call it the world of Harry Schmotter, where George Weasley happens to be Seeker for Slytherin, and another. Call it the world of Harry Potter, where George happens to be chaser for Hufflepuff. And what about the world of Harry Potter, where they play golf instead of Quidditch? Or the world of Harry Potter, where they wear bathing suits instead of robes? The problem, as the philosopher David Lewis, 1941 to 2001, pointed out, is that every way that a world could possibly be is a way that some imaginary world is. So, it's simply not useful to think of the task of the fictional storyteller as being like the task of the real-world historian or biographer. It's pretty clear that the historian is engaged in an act of discovery, and it's pretty clear what kinds of things she's discovering. Only one world is the actual world, and the hard part for the historian or the biographer is figuring out what happened in it. But there are as many imaginary worlds as there are imaginative possibilities. So the hard part for the fictional storyteller is deciding which imaginary world to tell us about. And it's far from clear whether to call this an act of discovery or instead to call it an act of creation. To put the same point in a slightly different way, the problem with figuring out whether George Weasley was a Gryffindor beater is true of the world of Harry Potter is the problem of figuring out which one of the infinitely many possible imaginary worlds is the world of Harry Potter. And that leaves us right where we started. Let's try to approach our problem from a slightly different direction. Let's think about Harry Potter as an act of communication in which a writer, J.K. Rowling, is trying to give her readers access to a particular imaginary world that she envisions. She does this by writing certain words that she expects her readers to understand in certain ways. Let's assume for the time being that there are no difficulties involved in understanding the literal meanings of the sentences she has written. By writing those words, she lets the readers know exactly which world she is envisioning. That is, she lets them know which world is the world of Harry Potter. And let's try again from this perspective to ask, what is true in the world of Harry Potter? We can start with a simple two-part proposal, one that we will end up needing to revise. According to this proposal, what's true in the world of Harry Potter are A, all, and B, only those things that appear on 4,100 pages that together compose the seven core Harry Potter volumes, perhaps with the addition of Quidditch Through the Ages, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and The Tales of Beedle the Bard. How does Part A of this proposal fare? It certainly seems like a good beginning, but there's one minor problem. If we require that the stories be consistent, we can talk in a minute about whether this is a reasonable requirement, then we can't take everything that appears on those pages as true in the fiction, for there are trivial inconsistencies across the books. In Sorcerer's Stone, for example, Percy Weasley's prefect badge is described as silver, whereas in Order of the Phoenix, we're told that prefect badges are scarlet and gold. In Chamber of Secrets, we're told that Moaning Myrtle haunts the toilet's S-bend, but in Goblet of Fire, she's said to haunt the toilet's U-bend. If we require consistency, we'll need to accept either the S-bend claim or the U-bend claim, but not both. Which one should we choose? Presumably the one that Rowling tells us she really meant. We'll come back to this issue in a later section. With this caveat in place, it seems reasonable to say that all of the things that are written down on those 4,100 plus pages are true in the world of Harry Potter. That is, it seems reasonable to say that the world of Harry Potter is one of the worlds in which the things written down on those 4,100 plus pages are true. Let's call these things the world's primary truths. Before we turn to B, let's return to the claim that the world of Harry Potter is supposed to be internally coherent. What sense of supposed to be are we talking about? Well, it seems pretty clear that for the most part, the world described in the Potter books is a coherent one, as evidenced by the fact that the inconsistencies are so rare, and Rowling's readers expect her to be describing an internally coherent world, as evidenced by the fact that when there are inconsistencies, readers point them out as notable. It's also obvious that Rowling intends to be describing a coherent world, as evidenced by the fact that she corrected these inconsistencies in later editions. Moreover, it seems apparent that the Harry Potter books are the kind of books in which internal consistency is prized, they belong to a genre, that is, a category of literary compositions characterized by certain conventions, where internal consistency is a hallmark. We'll come back to these four criteria: textual evidence, reader response, authorial intent, and genre constraints in our discussion further on. But to get there, let's consider B, the suggestion that the only things that are true in the world of Harry Potter are the primary truths. In contrast to A, B seems more problematic, for here are some things that are not primary truths in the world of Harry Potter: that Hermione Granger has 10 fingers, that Lavender Brown is more than 2 feet tall, that Helga Hufflepuff was never governor of Missouri, and that Cedric Diggory does not play for the Boston Red Sox. After all, there's no sentence in any of the Potter books that reads, "Hermione had 10 fingers," or "Cedric Diggory, though an excellent Quidditch player, was not a member of a Major League Baseball team." And if it seems reasonable to think that these things are true in the world of Harry Potter, along with tons of others that are not explicitly stated in the text, then what makes them true? What principles govern the generation of what we might call secondary truths? One major source of secondary fictional truths are non-fictional truths imported from the actual world. Presumably, most readers think that in the world of Harry Potter, the Earth revolves around the sun, cats have 4 legs, and January precedes February. Although these things aren't explicitly stated in the books, they are consistent with the story's primary truths, and they help fill out the imaginary world in a way that seems useful and natural. But is it true in the world of Harry Potter that Christopher Columbus set sail in 1492, or that John Lennon sang with the Beatles? Although these things are consistent with the story's primary truths, they don't seem necessary to help fill out the imaginary world. And what about things like Princess Diana and Prince Charles divorcing during Harry's years at Hogwarts, or that during those years, iPods became popular? These are not outright inconsistent with the story's primary truths, but they seem somewhat in tension with the imaginary world. And how about the real-world facts about Harry Potter itself? That the movie version of Goblet of Fire was directed by Mike Newell, or that Deathly Hallows sold more than 11 million copies in its first 24 hours. Nothing in the stories explicitly rules them out, but surely we don't want to say that these things are true in the world of Harry Potter. These examples bring out the problem with accepting what we might call the maximal inclusiveness principle. That everything that is true in the actual world is true in the fictional world, unless it is explicitly contradicted by a primary fictional truth. For that principle would make it true, in the world of Harry Potter, that you are listening to this chapter right now. Moreover, it's not clear that we even want such a precise principle. Do we really think there is a genuine fact of the matter, whether it is true in the world of Harry Potter, that Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz independently discovered or invented calculus? Thanks, guys. Would we really want to say that someone who denies that this is true in the world of Harry Potter is wrong, or that he doesn't properly understand the story? And wouldn't a similar issue arise, whichever specific principle we chose? As Aristotle famously said, our discussion will be adequate if its clarity fits its subject matter. The educated person seeks exactness in each area to the extent that the nature of the subject allows. It is just as mistaken to demand demonstrations from the rhetorician as it is to accept merely persuasive arguments from the mathematician. So it looks like when we ask about a story's secondary truths, we should be asking for rules of thumb about what allows us to make best sense of, or to best appreciate, the work of fiction. And really, what else could there be? Unless we go back to a picture in which the task of a fiction writer is like that of an actual reporter, whose job it is to tell us about a single, fully specified imaginary world, it seems odd to require that there must be a definitive fact of the matter about whether every single potential secondary truth is or is not part of the story world. So, is Dumbledore gay? Let's go back to our central question. Is it true in the world of Harry Potter that Dumbledore is gay? And think about what sorts of considerations we can bring to bear in answering that question. As we noted, there seem to be 4 places we can look: textual evidence, reader response, authorial intent, and genre constraints. As far as textual evidence goes, it's clear that Dumbledore is gay is not a primary truth in Harry Potter. That sentence appears nowhere in the 4,100-plus canonical pages. So the question is whether it is a secondary truth. Clearly, it's not the sort of secondary truth that can be imported directly from the actual world, because Dumbledore is a fictional character. But is it the kind of implied secondary truth that astute readers can be expected to pick up on? For example, from the way Rowling describes Dumbledore's intense relationship with Gellert Grindelwald in Deathly Hallows.
You cannot imagine how his ideas inflamed me.
And the fact that no heterosexual romantic interests of Dumbledore's are ever mentioned. Here it seems fair to say that while it is compatible with the story's primary truths, and perhaps even suggested by them, we'll come back to this at the end of this section, it is not strictly implied by them. And indeed, this was the response of some of the book's most careful readers. When actress Emma Watson, who plays Hermione, was told that Dumbledore is gay, she responded, "It never really occurred to me before, but now that J.K. Rowling said that he's gay, it sort of makes sense." Yet why should it matter what Rowling says? As readers have complained, if the series is truly at an end, then the author no longer possesses the authority to create new thoughts, feelings, and realities for those characters. To insist on ownership after the fact is to insist on absolute control over the literary experience of her readers she cannot possibly have. And indeed, this sort of view of authorial authority is held, in various forms, by leading critics of authorial intent, such as William K. Wimsatt, Monroe C. Beardsley, Hans Georg Gadamer, Roland Barthes, Michel Foucault, and Jacques Derrida. They point out, for example, that language is a social creation and that authors do not have the power simply to make words mean what they choose. If a professor announces to her class that there will be a test on Thursday, then even if she intended to say Tuesday, she can't simply claim that what her words meant was that there will be a test on Tuesday. Of course, she can claim that she meant to say Tuesday, but she can't claim that in saying Thursday, she said words that meant Tuesday. Similarly, if an author has a character recite a piece of poetry that the author intends to be a work of great beauty and profundity, but that consists of the words hickory dickory dock, creature took my sock, it doesn't follow that hickory dickory dock, creature took my sock, is a great poem. By this reasoning, it's not up to Rowling to say whether Dumbledore is gay. Her texts need to be allowed to speak for themselves, and each of their readers is a qualified listener. One implication of this view is that there is no single correct meaning or interpretation of a given text. Different readers approach the text from different historical and cultural contexts, and their engagement with the text will almost certainly give rise to multiple interpretations. The Harry Potter books might mean one thing to me, another thing to you, and another thing to J.K. Rowling, with no one interpretation privileged over any of the others. According to this sort of view, the whole idea of trying to figure out what is going on in the world of Harry Potter is misguided. There isn't a single world that is the world of Harry Potter. There are as many Potter worlds as there are readers. By contrast, intentionalist literary theorists, such as E.D. Hirsch Jr., argue that authorial intent is what fixes a text's correct interpretation. Without such a constraint, Hirsch contends, one uses the text merely as grist for one's own mill. And, at least to the extent that readers' primary concern is with understanding what an author meant to communicate, intention is obviously central. If I ask you whether you love me, and you respond by reciting a poem, my primary interest will not be in trying to interpret the poem from a unique historico-cultural perspective. My primary interest will be in trying to understand what you intended to convey by reciting it. Likewise, if I'm trying to understand a garbled military order, interpreting what I believe to be a divinely authored text, trying, as a judge, to discover a legislature's original intent, or offering what I hope will be the definitive interpretation of Plato's Timaeus, my primary, if not exclusive interest, will be in reconstructing the relevant authorial intent. And this is also true for many readers of the Harry Potter books. Why? because for most Potter fans, Rowling is the patented owner and creator of the Potter universe. She's the master storyteller who has the right, indeed, the unique prerogative, to authoritatively fill out, embellish, and continue her story. Rowling herself seems to endorse this view, claiming that Dumbledore is my character, he is what he is, and I have the right to say what I say about him. And in informing us, extra-canonically, that Dumbledore is gay, Rowling is filling out for us, in a kind of oral appendix to the Potter books, details of the story that she wishes her readers to know. Readers are free, of course, to read the relevant texts differently. It is, as they say, a free country. But most Potter fans are primarily interested in how Rowling chooses to fill out her imagined world. And unless we have a specific reason to discount what she says in this case, as we might, for example, if we think she misspoke and said Dumbledore when she meant Madam Hooch, it's hard to see how we could consistently accept all of the other details and backstories that Rowling has revealed only in the context of her hundreds of interviews and postings. Closing speculations. Genre. Although, for many readers, Rowling's declaration settles the matter, it is nonetheless interesting to think about the question from the perspective of our final theme, that of genre. One way that a reader might argue against the suggestion that Dumbledore is gay would be to contend that Harry Potter belongs to a genre of children's stories in which issues of adult sexuality do not arise. According to this sort of account, it simply isn't faithful to the story to say that Dumbledore is gay. Not because he's straight, or even asexual, but because it doesn't make sense to speak about his sexuality at all. But while this might be a plausible argument in the case of Goodnight Moon or The Wizard of Oz, it's hard to see how it could be maintained for Harry Potter, given that Rubeus Hagrid and Madame Maxime have a book-length flirtation, and that Severus Snape's hatred of Harry is partly explained by his unrequited love for Lily Potter. Indeed, one might even counter that facts about genre help the case that Dumbledore is gay. For the Harry Potter books do belong to a genre of young adult fiction in which adults' personal needs and desires are largely invisible to the youthful protagonists. And this would help explain why no mention of Dumbledore's sexuality is made in the text, despite it being an important fact about the larger imaginary world. Alternatively, one might argue that Harry Potter belongs to a genre of imaginary stories in which the number of minority identities is limited. While it's true that Cho Chang is Chinese, and the Patil sisters are Indian, and Lee Jordan is black, it's also true that the decorations at the Yule Ball don't seem to include Hanukkah menorahs, and that we hear nothing about students who are fasting during Ramadan, or lighting bonfires for Holi, or making use of a wheelchair, or communicating using sign language or reading in Braille. Fair enough. But one might counter that Rowling's approach to minority issues is actually rather nuanced. At the level of literal storytelling, tolerance is clearly the norm. Interracial dating is such a non-issue as not to warrant explicit mention. But at a metaphoric level, issues of minority identity are raised throughout the novels. Think of Tonks's willingness to marry Lupin despite his disability status, werewolf. Hermione's mission to liberate the house elves, or the recurring talk of mudbloods and purebloods and wizard supremacy. In this light, the limited literal treatment of issues of minority identity throughout the texts helps the case that Dumbledore is gay. For again, it provides some explanation for why no explicit mention is made of this fact in the 4,100-plus canonical pages. By introducing Dumbledore as a character with whom readers come to identify, Rowling catches her readers in an act of unwitting toleration. She brings them to recognise that, like interracial dating, sexual orientation is such a non-issue as not to warrant explicit mention. Finally, one might argue against Dumbledore's being gay on the grounds that it does no work in illuminating the story, which renders Rowling's declaration at best an irrelevant fillip. But it seems clear that Dumbledore's love for Grindelwald does important plot work. As Rowling remarked at Carnegie Hall, to an extent, do we say it excused Dumbledore a little more, because falling in love can blind us to an extent. But he met someone as brilliant as he was, and was very drawn to this brilliant person, and horribly, terribly let down by him. throughout the Harry Potter series, characters fall in true love with those who are their authentic peers. James Potter and Lily Evans are brave and charming. Molly and Arthur Weasley are decent and loyal. Tonks and Lupin are courageous and unlucky. Bill Weasley and Fleur Delacour are dashing and attractive. Dumbledore's great power is his intellect. Could it be that Dumbledore is gay because Rowling could not conceive of there being a woman who was his intellectual equal? Chapter 11. Choices versus Abilities. Dumbledore on Self-Understanding. Gregory Basham. To know thyself, said Socrates, is the beginning of wisdom. Who am I? What are my deepest desires? What are my talents? How can I live most authentically? Does my life have a purpose? What goals should I pursue? From the beginning of Western philosophy, such questions have been at the heart of the quest for wisdom and perspective. The search for self-understanding is a central theme of the Harry Potter books. At the beginning of Sorcerer's Stone, Harry knows almost nothing about who he is or where he comes from. He thinks he is an ordinary, poor, unknown boy living in a humdrum and non-mysterious world. As the stories unfold, Harry realizes that none of these things are true, and he achieves a progressively deeper understanding of himself, his abilities, and his place in the world. In traditional philosophical language, the Potter books are a tale of personal enlightenment. They describe Harry's long and difficult journey from appearance to reality. Harry's quest for self-understanding has many twists and turns, and he frequently wrestles with his sense of identity. Remember the end of Chamber of Secrets? Harry is alarmed to discover that he shares many qualities with Voldemort, including the rare and somewhat sinister ability to speak Parseltongue. Recalling how the Sorting Hat almost put him in Slytherin rather than Gryffindor, Harry wonders whether there is a dark side to his character. Professor Dumbledore reassures him, pointing out that his actions have been very different from Voldemort's, and adding, "It is our choices, Harry, that show us what we truly are. Far more than our abilities." The philosopher and Potter scholar Tom Morris has aptly described this as one of the most important philosophical insights in the Harry Potter books. What does Dumbledore mean? What are choices? How do they differ from abilities? And is it true that our choices tell us more about ourselves than our abilities do? Choices. Choice is a topic philosophers have written a great deal about. One of the earliest philosophers to grapple with the issue was Aristotle, 384 to 322 BCE, who in his Nicomachean Ethics carefully distinguished choice, prohairesis, from related concepts such as wish, appetite, emotion, and voluntary decision. He concluded that choice is a kind of deliberative desire for things that are within our power. Aristotle argued that choices are a better test of character than actions are, and Dumbledore's similar remark may well be an echo of Aristotle's famous discussion. Philosophers have noted that choice is used in various senses. Sometimes it refers to a purely internal mental event, an act of decision that may or may not result in any overt physical act. Someone who says, "Draco Malfoy chose to murder Dumbledore, but in the end he couldn't bring himself to do so," is using chose in this purely internal sense. Call this kind of choice internal choice. Sometimes choice refers not to any interior mental decision, but to an observable physical act performed in a context of presumed alternatives. To say that Dumbledore made some poor choices in his youth is to use choice in this second sense. Call this kind of choice act choice. There is a third sense of choice that combines both internal and external elements. Consider a well-known example offered by the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804. Storekeeper A and Storekeeper B both choose not to cheat their customers. Storekeeper A does this because he's afraid of going to jail. Storekeeper B does it because he's honest and wants to do the right thing. Have Storekeeper A and Storekeeper B made the same choice? No, Kant said. Storekeeper B's choice is a different and morally worthier act than Storekeeper A's. In this scenario, there are three distinguishable aspects of Storekeeper B's choice. An internal act of decision, deciding not to cheat the customer. An observable physical act, dealing with the customer honestly. And an internal motive, treating the customer honestly because it's the right thing to do. In this third sense of choice, we can't really know what choice a person has made unless we know that person's motive for doing what he or she did. Call this third and most complex sense of choice, motive choice. How revealing are our choices? Now that we've determined the various meanings of choice, we can ask whether Dumbledore is right in claiming that it is our choices rather than our abilities that are most revealing of who we truly are. Clearly, internal choices by themselves may tell us very little about our true selves. For example, the mere fact that Dudley Dursley has decided to give up sweets won't give him, or us, much insight into his character unless we know why he gave them up, whether he can stick to his resolution for any length of time and so forth. Similarly, act choices may not reveal a great deal about our inner selves. Character, as Aristotle reminds us, is a matter of settled disposition, of habit, not individual actions. Just because Hermione Granger occasionally breaks rules, for example, in helping to organise Dumbledore's army, doesn't mean that she is a habitual rule-breaker. Moreover, as Kant's example of the two storekeepers makes clear, a person's overt physical actions may tell us little about his or her internal motivations. In the Potter books, this point is brilliantly illustrated in the character of Severus Snape. To outside observers, Snape's actions often appear to be those of a devoted follower of Voldemort. Yet in the end, we realise that Snape's true loyalties were to Dumbledore and the memory of Lily Potter. The most revealing kinds of choices will generally be motive choices. Motive choices convey more information than either internal choices or act choices do. They tell us not only what choice we have made mentally, but also what motivated us to make the choice, and whether we had the strength and consistency of character to act on the choice. Dumbledore is probably thinking of choices in this third and most complex sense when he praises Harry at the end of Chamber of Secrets and states that choices are more revealing than abilities. The choices Dumbledore is referring to, for example, Harry's decision to risk his life by entering the Chamber of Secrets in order to save Ginny Weasley, are not simply Harry's internal decisions or his bare physical acts. Dumbledore is praising the total package. A, Harry's decision. B, to enter the Chamber of Secrets in order to save Ginny Weasley. C, which he acted on, despite the obstacles and known dangers. In this sense, Harry's choice was indeed highly revealing of his character. Are there cases where our motive choices won't reveal much about our true characters? Sure. Trivial choices, such as picking pumpkin pasties rather than cauldron cakes from the cart on the Hogwarts Express, won't tell us much about our deeper selves. More significantly, our motive choices can be uninformative, or even downright deceptive, if we are mistaken about either our true motives in making a particular choice or the real nature or value of that choice. With his vast capacity for self-deception, Vernon Dursley may think that his motive for treating Harry so shabbily is to protect him from magical funny stuff for his own good. But if his real motive is to punish Harry for possessing special powers, or for burdening the Dursleys with his unwanted presence, Uncle Vernon's motive choice, as he understands it, will conceal his true character rather than reveal it. Motive acts can also deceive those who are unaware of the true nature of their actions. Vernon and Petunia Dursley think they are great parents who shower their special dinky-duddy-dums with love and affection. In reality, of course, they are terrible parents who spoil and coddle Dudley shamelessly. Because of their cluelessness in this respect, they mistakenly believe that their parenting choices show their characters in a positive light. Thus, instead of learning from these choices, they are actually misled by them. In J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World, there is a further reason that one's own motive choices may not contribute to self-understanding. In that world, it may be hard to know whether it was really you who made a particular choice. Think of the scene in Order of the Phoenix when Harry thought it was he who attacked Arthur Weasley in the form of a giant snake. Only later does he find out that it was Voldemort who tried to kill Mr. Weasley, and that Harry was sharing the Dark Lord's experiences by means of the fragment of Voldemort's soul that he carries within him. Or think of the episode in Half-Blood Prince, when Voldemort steals Morfin Gaunt's wand, uses it to kill his Muggle father and grandparents, and then implants a false memory in Morfin's mind, making Morfin think that he had murdered the Riddles. Finally, think of the perplexities that can arise due to magical spells, such as the Imperious Curse, Polyjuice Potion, and Memory Modification. Imagine that Fred and George Weasley have bewitched a bottle of Ogden's Old Fire Whiskey so that it looks and tastes like butterbeer. You drink it and fall asleep in a stupor. The next morning you're called into Dumbledore's office and accused of transfiguring Filch's cat, Mrs. Norris, into an armadillo. Did you do it? You remember nothing, but three students from Hufflepuff swear they saw you bewitch the cat. Dumbledore performs the Priori Incantatum charm on your wand and determines that it was your wand that cast the spell. Three possibilities occur to you. 1. You performed the spell but can't remember it because of the booze, or perhaps because your memory was modified. 2. You performed the spell but only because you were under the Imperious Curse and you have no memory of the act, because no one remembers anything they do while under that curse. 3. Somebody disguised as you due to Polyjuice Potion performed the spell using your wand. If one is true, then it was your choice to transfigure the cat, and you may be at least somewhat responsible for the misuse of magic. If, however, 2 or 3 is true, you didn't voluntarily perform the spell, and you're not guilty of misuse of magic. What really happened? There may be no way to know. Consequently, no firm conclusions about your character can be drawn from the episode, except that you are a dimwit to ever trust Fred and George. As these examples make clear, there are special difficulties in the wizarding world in knowing what choices you have made. The boundaries between self and other are less clear in that world than in ours, and the possibilities of manipulation, control, and illusion are greater. Still, in Rowling's world, as in ours, choices do often reveal valuable insights about ourselves. According to Dumbledore, choices are far more informative in this way than abilities are. To see whether he is right, we need to understand what abilities are and how they differ from choices. Abilities. The notion of ability, as the psychologist Michael J.A. Howe notes, is a fuzzy concept. In general, an ability is a power or a capacity to do something. Thus, Voldemort has the rare ability to fly without a broomstick because he possesses the requisite magical skills that allow him to fly in this way. Similarly, Sirius, as an animagus, has the ability to transform himself into a large black dog because he has the self-taught capability to do so. This much is clear, but what makes the concept of an ability fuzzy is that abilities come in degrees and often vary with circumstances. I speak about 70 words of Mirmish, the language of the Mer people. You speak 300 words. Do I have the ability to speak Mirmish? To some extent, but not as well as you. I can conjure a chipmunk Patronus, but only when I'm really mellow and relaxed, which is rare. Do I have the ability to conjure such a Patronus? Sometimes, but not very often. In other words, it's not always clear whether someone has a certain ability or not. This is one way that choices differ from abilities. Choices tend to be more clear-cut than abilities are. As we've seen, choices are acts, either mental or physical. Normally, there's a definite answer whether someone did or did not make a particular choice. Did Peter Pettigrew choose to betray Harry's parents rather than be killed by Voldemort? No question. Did Harry choose to break up with Ginny at the end of Half-Blood Prince in order to protect her? Absolutely. By contrast, abilities are powers or capacities rather than acts. As such, they tend to come in degrees and to be more variable than choices are. How revealing are our abilities? Dumbledore suggests that our choices tend to be more self-revealing than our abilities. Is he right? Well, some kinds of abilities will reveal little or nothing about a person's character or inner self. In general, these include abilities that are trivial, for example, the ability to wiggle your ears, very widely shared, for example, the ability to digest granola, not within one's conscious control, for example, the ability to breathe while sleeping, innate, rather than acquired, for example, the ability to cry, unrecognized, for example, Harry's ability to speak Parseltongue before he first became aware of the talent in Sorcerer's Stone. More important, many sorts of abilities won't be particularly revealing because they are morally neutral capacities that can be used wisely or unwisely, ethically or unethically. This seems to be Dumbledore's point when he remarks that Harry shares many qualities Salazar Slytherin prized in his hand-picked students. His own very rare gift, Parseltongue, resourcefulness, determination, a certain disregard for rules. Notice that each of the qualities Dumbledore mentions can be used for good or evil ends. For instance, both Voldemort and Harry are resourceful. Yet Voldemort uses his resourcefulness to pursue his goals of world domination and personal immortality, whereas Harry uses his to save his friends and fight tyranny. Likewise, both Dumbledore and Voldemort possess exceptional magical abilities, yet Dumbledore uses his magical talents to do good, whereas Voldemort uses his to do evil. So, simply having qualities like resourcefulness or advanced magical abilities won't reveal much about what kind of person you are. It's how you use these abilities that really matters. Does this mean that abilities never reveal much about a person's character? By no means. Abilities that can be acquired only through hard work, self-sacrifice, and determination can tell us a lot about a person. The same is true of ethical abilities, such as a capacity to empathize with others' suffering, to think of other people's needs before your own, to plan prudently for the future, and to remain resilient in the face of disappointment. So, if Dumbledore means that choices are generally more self-revealing than abilities, he is no doubt correct. But at the same time, we should also be honest and self-reflective about our abilities, because they, too, can tell us a great deal about ourselves and how we can live most happily and successfully. Beyond choices, toward a deeper self-understanding. Reflecting on your past choices may tell you a lot about yourself, but it may not. Consider Gilderoy Lockhart. Lockhart thinks about himself a lot, all of the time, in fact, but his self-image is completely out of whack. He imagines that he's a great Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, but he can't even manage a cage full of Cornish pixies. Although he poses as an expert duelist, he is easily blasted off his feet by Snape's Expelliarmus spell. He vainly imagines that everyone is a fan of his, and when he confidently claims to be able to fix Harry's injured arm, he ends up removing all of Harry's arm bones instead. Why the big disconnect? Because Lockhart is blind to his own faults. He looks, but doesn't see. This is the basic problem with seeking self-understanding simply by reflecting on one's own choices. If you're wearing rose-coloured glasses, what psychologists call cognitive blinders, you're not going to see the real you. So, what's a better strategy for achieving self-knowledge? If we look at what the great thinkers have said on this topic, we can identify four major strategies. Cultivate a habit of self-examination. Be alert to your irrational tendencies. Get a little help from your friends. Challenge yourself. As we'll see, each of these principles is well illustrated in the Potter books. Cultivate a habit of self-examination. Self-knowledge requires time, openness, and humility. What are my deepest values and commitments? What do I like? What do I dislike? What am I most passionate about? What are my greatest strengths and weaknesses? Am I the person I want to be? How can I make the most of my time and talents? What would I like to be remembered for when I'm gone? These are tough questions, and answering them takes time. It also requires openness and humility, because, as Socrates pointed out, most of us find it very difficult to face unpleasant truths about ourselves and to admit our own limitations. As the philosopher Thomas Pangle remarked, most of the time when we reflect seriously, it's because we're in trouble. Some life crisis happens. We lose a job, get divorced, flunk out of school, get a really bad haircut. Only then, it seems, do we seriously evaluate where we are in our lives and the choices we've made. But life should not be lived on autopilot. Just as we need to develop good habits of diet and exercise, we need to form positive habits of mindfulness and self-examination. Only by knowing yourself can you live honestly and find your own path. Dumbledore is a model of a reflective, self-aware individual. When he was a young man, he realized that his besetting weakness was a love of power. Realizing this, he never accepted the position of Minister of Magic, although it was offered to him several times. Dumbledore also drew an important lesson from his infatuation with the future dark wizard, Gellert Grindelwald. In a 2008 interview, Rowling stated that Dumbledore lost his moral compass completely when he fell in love with Grindelwald. As a result, Dumbledore became very distrusting of his judgment in matters of the heart and decided to live a celibate and scholarly life. In his effort to live what Socrates called the examined life, Dumbledore regularly uses the pensieve, a magical stone basin that allows individuals to view either their own or another person's memories from a third-person perspective. Dumbledore tells Harry that whenever he has too many thoughts and memories crammed into his mind, he uses the pensieve to siphon off some of these excess thoughts. This unclutters the mind, removes painful or obsessive memories, and improves mental focus. The third-person perspective also makes it easier to spot patterns and links, and to notice things that weren't consciously observed in the original experiences. Clearly, such a device would be a great tool for self-understanding, not to mention as an instant replay device at the Quidditch World Cup. Be alert to your irrational tendencies. Aristotle classically defined humans as the rational animal, but obviously he had never watched an episode of the Jerry Springer Show. The fact is that we humans regularly fall prey to irrational biases, prejudices, egocentrism, close-mindedness, wishful thinking, and stereotyping. And as we've seen, your choices may not tell you much about your true self if, like the Dursleys or Lockhart, your self-image is distorted by poor thinking habits. The solution is to recognize and actively combat one's irrational tendencies. As much as we might like to think of ourselves as unusually self-aware and perceptive individuals, we're all human and thus heir to all of the thinking flaws that humans are so often prone to. Pretty much the full range of human irrationality is on display in the Potter novels. Think of Percy Weasley's rule fetish and love of power, Malfoy's virulent racism and classism, Ron Weasley's irrational jealousy, Rubius Hagrid's blind affection for dangerous magical creatures, Cornelius Fudge's close-mindedness, or Luna Lovegood's credulity for tales of the uncanny. But Rowling's best example of irrational thinking is Wizard's treatment of house elves. House elves are effectively slaves in the wizarding world. They are bound for life to well-to-do wizarding families or to institutions such as Hogwarts. They perform unpaid menial tasks, are given limited education, wear cast-off items such as old pillowcases as clothing, are forbidden to use wands, and can be beaten, tormented, and even killed by their masters with apparent impunity. Yet very few wizards see this kind of indentured servitude as morally problematic in the least. Why this ethical blindness? Because as Ron and Hagrid note, with the exception of weirdos like Dobby, nearly all house elves like being slaves, and even regard freedom, as Winky does, as something depressing and shameful. As Hermione points out, however, the fact that house elves have been conditioned to buy into their own oppression does not justify the practice. Although Harry at first shares the conventional prejudices regarding house elves, in the end he accepts Hermione's view, digging Dobby's grave with his own hands and writing, "Here lies Dobby, a free elf," on the tombstone. In this process of moral growth, Harry is greatly helped by his friend Hermione, a tireless advocate for elf rights. This leads to our third pointer. Get a little help from your friends. Humans aren't like the Borg in Star Trek. We don't have a collective consciousness in which we directly experience other people's thoughts and emotions. Instead, we live our lives from the inside, from the vantage point of our own personal minicam on life. This gives us a privileged access to what's going on inside our own heads. But sometimes we can be too close to ourselves to see us as we truly are. We lack perspective, objectivity. That's where friends can help. Friends can tell you when you're being selfish or rude or making a total fool of yourself. Conversely, they can let you know when you're being kind or generous or need to lighten up on yourself. In the Potter books, friends frequently play a vital role in enhancing one another's self-understanding. For instance, Hermione helps Harry understand why he was being insensitive to Cho Chang on their trip to Hogsmeade. Harry, Ron and Hermione assist Neville Longbottom in overcoming his painful shyness and lack of self-confidence. And Hagrid helps Ron understand why friendships should not be wrecked by petty jealousies. By the same token, characters who apparently lack close and supportive friendships, such as the Dursleys, Lockhart and Professor Slughorn, tend not to progress in self-understanding. Honest and caring friends can be a mirror in which we see ourselves as we really are. Challenge yourself. In ordinary life, people tend to behave in stereotypical ways. You can't tell much about a person by watching how she brushes her teeth or walks to the bus stop. It's in out-of-the-ordinary situations, especially situations of challenge or adversity, that the most important differences between people shine through. That's why, as the Roman philosopher-poet Lucretius observed, it is more useful to scrutinize a man in danger or peril and to discern in adversity what manner of man he is. For only then are the words of truth drawn up from the very heart. The mask is torn off. The reality remains. In the Potter books, Harry and his friends are repeatedly tested. Over and over, they are placed in situations that test their courage, loyalty, intelligence, and resourcefulness. With a few notable exceptions, such as Ron's temporary abandonment of Harry and Hermione in Deathly Hallows, they pass these tests with flying colours and prove their true mettle. As a result, they grow in self-confidence and self-knowledge and emerge at the end, much like Frodo and his hobbit friends in J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, as humble but battle-tested heroes. The ultimate measure of a person. So, in the final analysis, Dumbledore is right when he says that our choices tend to be more revealing than our abilities. Our abilities show us what we can do, but our choices reveal, most clearly, our qualities of character and what we care about most deeply. In this sense, it is true, as the author Tobias Wolff remarks, that we define ourselves and our deepest values by the choices we make, day by day, hour by hour, over a lifetime. But as we've seen, some choices are more revealing than others. The ultimate measure of a person is where he stands when tested by challenge or adversity. By this measure, Harry and his friends all earn O's for outstanding. Chapter 12. The Magic of Personal Transformation. S. Joel Garver. When we first meet Dudley Dursley, he's an utter prat. Dudley despises Harry and treats him like a dog that had rolled in something smelly. Dudley always wants his own way, and when it comes to his parents, Petunia and Vernon, he knows how to get it. Dudley thinks he's always in the right and can do no wrong. He can't see himself as anything but God's gift to the world, a model of juvenile perfection, entitled to every good thing that comes his way. And Dudley can't recognize Harry as anything but a nuisance, a worthless distraction, a potential threat to Ickle Duddes's own comfort and ease. Yet, by the beginning of Deathly Hallows, Dudley has changed dramatically. He leaves a cup of tea for Harry outside Harry's room at number 4 Privet Drive, and he defies his parents to instead do what Harry urges. Dudley ultimately manages to express something like affection and gratitude toward Harry, even in the face of his parents' incomprehension and his own embarrassment. In the end, when Dudley shakes Harry's hand and says goodbye, Harry sees a different personality. What happened? How did Dudley come to see Harry in a new way? Not as a nuisance, but with a newfound respect. And does this mean that Dudley came to see himself differently than before? If so, how did this change occur? These are questions about how Dudley develops as a person, but they also raise fascinating epistemological issues. Epistemology is the part of philosophy that asks and tries to answer questions about how we know stuff. Specifically, let's consider how Dudley and Harry came to know both themselves and others better than they did before. By examining how these two characters grow and develop, we can understand how Rowling presents knowing as a process of personal transformation. As we'll see, when we encounter ourselves and others in significant ways, we grow in mind and heart and become better knowers. Positioning our prejudgments. In order to know and interpret our world, said the German philosopher Hans Georg Gadamer, 1900-2002, we must come to the world with prejudgments. Every time we try to interpret a situation, a person, or a text, we bring questions, biases, and expectations with us, like bringing a handful of tools from a well-worn toolbox. Without such prejudgments, we wouldn't have any way to get into whatever it is we're trying to understand. It would be like a container sealed shut, and we'd be left standing there, helpless and empty-handed. Our prejudgments shape, in turn, the kinds of information we're able to get out of what we're trying to understand. But if we come at things with the wrong tools, we aren't going to make much headway. What we're trying to interpret and understand will resist our advances. After all, we can't undo screws very easily with pliers, never mind with a hammer. Gadamer said that there's no use pretending we don't have prejudgments that craft how we think and perceive. The issue is whether our prejudgments will help us understand better or whether they'll get in the way. It's not simply that the wrong sorts of questions or expectations won't get us very far. Whether they help us understand also depends on how loosely we hold these prejudgments and whether we allow the situations we face to challenge and reshape our strategies. When we're face to face with a box screwed shut, do we have the sense to set down the hammer and scrounge around for a screwdriver instead? The ignorance of Ickle Dudleykins. If Gadamer's insight applies to our world, might it apply in Harry's as well? Dudley sees himself as the centre of the universe and interprets his world through his own bloated ego. This is due mainly to the way Petunia and Vernon constantly dote on him. In their eyes, there is no finer boy anywhere than their baby angel. They build up and reinforce Dudley's sense of self at Harry's expense, favouring their son over Harry with gifts, clothes, and special treats. Aunt Marge likewise is eager to visit her nephew Pooh Dudley and to slip him a £20 note. How could any child treated in this way feel anything but special and privileged? Furthermore, Dudley's sense of self resists any sort of retooling or change. Any information that can possibly challenge or modify Dudley's prejudgments is quickly papered over or given a new spin by his parents. They are able to find excuses for his bad marks, insisting that Dudley is a very gifted boy but misunderstood by his teachers, and they brush away accusations of bullying with the contention that although Dudley is a boisterous little boy, he wouldn't hurt a fly. Even when Dudley is forced to go on a diet, Aunt Petunia asserts that he is merely big-boned, a growing boy who simply has not yet shed his puppy fat. This environment of flattery and indulgence sculpts Dudley's own intellectual outlook by which he understands his world, his place in it, and his cousin Harry. As Mark Twain said, denial ain't just a river in Egypt. But Dudley's close encounter with the cold terror of the Dementors seriously shakes him and forces him to confront himself in a new way, requiring a radical readjustment of his previous sense of himself. As Harry knows, the Dementors cause Dudley to relive the worst moments of his life. All of Dudley's intellectual habits that were designed to reconfigure or push away the awful truth are stripped away. For the first time, Dudley sees clearly who he truly is. Spoiled, pampered, bullying. And begins to interpret his place in the world properly. When Dumbledore later speaks of the appalling damage that Petunia and Vernon have inflicted upon this unfortunate boy, perhaps Dudley is finally in a position to hear and accept Dumbledore's diagnosis, even if his parents are not. Dudley's obstinate prejudgments finally change so that he can receive and understand the truth. This new perspective on reality and his own place within it enables Dudley finally to recognize Harry's courage and capacity to help, and to feel gratitude for Harry's rescuing him, and perhaps even a certain admiration, if not affection, for his magical family member. Betrayed by biases. Dudley's experience isn't unique, but rather reflects the similar experiences of J.K. Rowling's other characters. Harry's temperament, biases, and expectations shape his own intellectual habits. Just consider Harry's ongoing prejudice against Severus Snape, his initial fear that Sirius Black is out to get him, his misplaced trust in the imposter Mad-Eye Moody, his confidence in the veracity of his own dreams, and his trust in the Half-Blood Prince's potions book. These habits, in turn, blind Harry to the reality of the situations around him. He can't see where the real dangers lie, who truly means him harm, and what's actually going on. He's oblivious to his own liability to deception, and the potential harm of the Sectum Sempra spell. Harry often comes at his world with the wrong sort of expectations and questions, and, as a result, doesn't end up with the right sort of answers. Because it's Harry's perspective we read as experience, we, too, are likely to interpret the unfolding events through the wrong filter. In similar ways, other characters misjudge the situations and the people around them. Dumbledore's youthful infatuation with Gellert Grindelwald feeds his ill-conceived dreams about wizards ruling the world for the greater good. Merope Gaunt is attracted to the wealthy Tom Riddle and desires to escape her miserable home life, leading her to think that Riddle might truly fall in love with her, even if she has to assist the process with a potion. In Deathly Hallows, Hermione Granger, Harry, and Ron Weasley find their own fears, suspicions, and biases magnified by the Locket Horcrux. They end up misreading one another until Ron finally runs off in a fit of paranoia, jealousy, and hurt. Likewise, the Malfoys' lust for pure-blood power impels them to underestimate the depths of evil to which Voldemort would sink. In each case, prejudgments make the characters misread the truth until the pain of banging up against reality forces them to rethink. This is why the truth is something to care about. False beliefs do not accurately depict the world, and thus prove to be an unreliable map for navigating through it. Dangerous dreams. Let's consider a specific example involving Harry. In Order of the Phoenix, Harry is understandably disturbed by his insight into Voldemort's thoughts. Such flashes of vision mostly happen when Harry is asleep and dreaming, when his mind is at its most relaxed and vulnerable. Yet Harry remains cocky in his own sense of mission in opposing Voldemort, wrongly believing that he uniquely understands Voldemort's true nature and capacities. So Harry comes to trust the truth of his dreams as a transparent window and privileged perspective into Voldemort's own mind. Dumbledore, however, warns Harry that if he can see into Voldemort's mind, then Voldemort can probably see into Harry's mind as well. And if Voldemort becomes aware of his connection to Harry, he could use his formidable powers of legitimacy to manipulate and deceive Harry. Harry, confident in his own ideas, discounts Dumbledore's warnings. Even when Dumbledore emphatically warns Harry that he must study occlumency, Harry neglects to practice and quickly falls prey to new dreams. Although Dumbledore himself sent Harry to Snape for lessons in occlumency, Harry's suspicions against Snape lead him to resist the training. Harry suggests instead that the lessons are making things worse. When Hermione urges him to keep practicing occlumency and to work harder at it, Harry likewise rejects her advice in a fit of frustration. His later conversation with Sirius Black suggests that Harry never really saw why occlumency was at all important. It's tempting, therefore, to think that Snape's accusation hits a bit too close to the truth.
Perhaps you actually enjoy having these visions and dreams, Potter. Maybe they make you feel special, important.
The cost of overconfidence. In this case, the price of Harry's prejudices is profound. The death of his godfather, Sirius Black. During his History of Magic Owl, Harry dozes and sees Sirius being tortured by Voldemort in the Department of Mysteries. His immediate reaction is to begin plotting some way of getting into the Ministry of Magic to rescue Sirius. Hermione raises a series of reasonable objections. Rather than doubt his own certainty, however, Harry snaps back at Hermione. He even turns Dumbledore's warnings on their heads in order to prop up his own beliefs, interpreting the occlumency lessons as proof that his dreams must be real. Hermione finally persuades Harry to check first whether Sirius is still at Grimmauld Place before trying a rescue. Using Professor Umbridge's office fireplace to connect to Sirius's home, Harry finds only the lugubrious and unreliable house elf Creature there. Creature is only too happy to confirm Harry's belief that Sirius has left for the Department of Mysteries. This is all Harry needs, so he single-mindedly undertakes the rescue that will lead to Sirius's death. What are we to make of this? Was Creature's testimony enough of a fact check to justify Harry's rescue attempt? Or was Harry again led astray by the bent of his own intellect and emotions, now twisted in the hands of Voldemort's craftiness? The danger of not thinking clearly is that Harry begins to see certain evidence as reliable that should instead be considered suspicious. Too often, Harry underestimates the many ways he's far less objective in assessing the evidence than he might like to think. Nothing up to this point in the story would suggest that Creature's testimony is worth taking seriously. Creature's behaviour seems pretty shady as Harry interviews him. He appears highly delighted about something with signs of recent injury to his hands, chuckling and cackling at Harry's interrogations. Indeed, as Dumbledore later points out, he had warned Sirius that his lack of concern and coldness toward Creature could have dangerous consequences. Harry, moreover, is acting all by himself in his trust of Creature's testimony, because he never bothers to share with his friends that the house elf was his source. We shouldn't be too hard on Harry, however. He is still only a 15-year-old kid and is acting with noble intentions. The dangers to which he falls prey remind us of times when we ourselves, because of either youth or cockiness, laziness or impetuousness, have seen what we wanted to see, thanks to blinders that blocked or skewed our picture of reality. Memories help make meaning. Memory plays a crucial role in how our biases and intellectual habits form, develop, and reshape. If we forget the past, individually, or as a culture, we lose knowledge that has already been gained, and we lose valuable tools by which our knowledge may grow. Thus, time can be the enemy of understanding, closing us off from the resources of the past that are necessary for knowing the present. What's already happened can disappear and be lost forever, entirely forgotten unless traces of the past somehow persist into the present. We can speak of these traces of the past as memories, especially as they register in our experience and consciousness. In his classic autobiography, The Confessions, the philosopher St. Augustine, 354 to 430 AD, tried to explain the nature of time and time's connection to memory. He noted that the past no longer exists and the future hasn't yet come into existence. How, then, can the past stay with us? Moreover, the present, as the place where the past and the future meet, has no duration of its own. What, then, is this ghostly, fleeting thing we call time? Augustine's answer was that time is only fully known in human experience. Through us, the memory of the past comes together with anticipation of the future in our present awareness. How we experience now is a function of how the past brings us to this